Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Melissa Clark, in this week for Lynn Rosetto Casper. I think that we think we have a lot of choices in what we eat, but not according to Simran Sethi, author of Bread, Wine, and Chocolate.
I decided to pay a visit to Walmart, which is the number one grocery chain in the United States, and I counted 153 flavors of ice cream, 8 different types of yogurt. You know, it looks like we have a plethora of choice, but it's primarily in flavor and secondarily in brand. And I'm just using, you know, ice cream and dairy products as an example, but every one of those containers of yogurt, milk, and ice cream came from one breed of cow. 90% of them came from one breed of cow, the Holstein Friesian.
Losing the foods we love, a new era in travel guides, and a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Melissa Clark from The New York Times, in for Lynn Rosetto Casper. We all have those friends who are simply good cooks. They seem to operate with a culinary ESP. You know, the bakers who insist on creaming butter that is softened but not warm, or the cooks who sprinkle salt in tiny bits throughout the entire cooking process. Are these just kitchen tricks? Absolutely not. It may be instinctive for some, but it is science to all. Anyone can be a better cook. And with that in mind, our managing producer, Sally Swift, is pairing up with Molly Birnbaum, the executive editor of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen, for a lesson in fundamentals.
Molly, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
So you talked to 10 different people about how to cut up an onion, and everyone has a different opinion. Does the way you cut onion and garlic make a difference to the way they taste?
It really does make a difference to the way they taste.
I knew you were going to say that.
It really does. When you cut an onion or a clove of garlic, what you're doing is you're inciting an interaction within that clove or piece of onion. You're rupturing cells with your knife or with your teeth if you're chewing. And when you break down those cells, you're releasing an enzyme. And that enzyme interacts with an amino acid that's in a different cell, right in that garlic. And when those two combine, they create a third component, one that has that super intense flavor or smell. And so the flavor of garlic or onion then effectively does not occur until you start cutting it or chewing it. And even after you chop it, that flavor will continue to build for about 10 minutes or more. So if you chop garlic ahead of time before you put it into a dish, it will get stronger and stronger and stronger.
So what are some tricks for manipulating? How would you have us go about it?
Well, when it comes to onions, what we recommend doing is cutting pole to pole with the grain of the onion so that you're rupturing less cells as you cut. Mm-hmm. With garlic, you can cut it into thin slices rather than mincing it up or putting it through a garlic press. The garlic press is what really kind of riles up all of those cells and interactions and smells.
I bet it's just completely pureed.
Just mashing it up right in there.
And so when you cook with it, what happens when you heat them?
Well, that's the other way of controlling the flavor of alliums like onions and garlic. The enzyme that interacts with the amino acid in there gets denatured at a certain temperature. So if you bring it up to about 140 degrees, which is a light saute, it's toasting a garlic clove with its skin still on, you know, in a dry pan for a while, that enzyme is no longer working. And so then it's no longer making these strong flavors. So a little bit of heat will totally mellow out the flavor.
And what about acid? I know lots of people soak onion, raw onion, in vinegar or sometimes ice bath to try to cool them down, to tame them a little bit. Does that work?
It does work. It helps a lot. We like soaking it in a little bit of lemon juice. And especially when you're making, say, a Caesar salad, that really complements the flavor of the dressing too. And it also does calm down the flavor of the garlic.
And what about salting? How does salt react with the two of them?
Well, one of the things that we like to do when it comes to sautéing onions, so you've chopped up onions, you want to sauté them for a dish, we like to add salt immediately when we put it in because the salt helps bring the moisture out of the onions and then will help them cook down and brown up a little bit faster. So you get a nicer, deeper, browner flavor.
So they sweat a little bit.
They sweat a little bit with the salt.
You did a funny test on how to not tear up when you're cutting onions and garlic.
Yes, we did a really fun and ridiculous test in which two of our test cooks in America's Test Kitchen, who are both very prone to crying. Some people are more criers than others when it comes to the very specific enzyme that onions have that causes your eyes to tear up. And what they did was they tried out every single test that they could think of, all of the myths, all of the legends, everything.
Including the unlit match in their teeth.
They put an unlit match in their teeth. They put a toothpick in their teeth. They put an onion on their head. They held a piece of bread in their mouth. I mean, they went full stop. And what they found that worked best was wearing contact lenses, which, of course, doesn't really work if you don't need contact lenses. Ski goggles.
Safety glasses.
Anything that kind of blocks that chemical from entering your eyes will help.
Nothing like making you laugh a little bit in the kitchen as well, you know?
Yes.
That's pretty great. Hey, and what is the truth about using garlic that has a sprout coming out of it? Do you remove the sprout? Do you leave it?
Well, we did some tests in the kitchen, and we found that while there's nothing wrong with eating the sprout, it does have a little bit of a bitter flavor, so we prefer to take it out before cooking with it.
All right. Well, that clarified some things. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Molly Birnbaum is the executive editor of Cooked Science from America's Test Kitchen. She left us with a recipe for pasta with garlic and oil. Find it at splendidtable.org. If you're the kind of person who plots their travels around where they're going to eat, we have a new kind of guidebook for you. Consider it a culinary treasure map designed to get you into the heart of a country's cuisine, in this case, Japan. Matt Goulding, editor and founder of Roads and Kingdoms, has written Rice Noodle Fish, Deep Travels Through Japan's Food Culture. He approaches Japan as a curious but conscious outsider. And while he can tell you where to get the best vending machine cocktails, he can also tell you about the Guatemalan chef who is the unlikely master of Hiroshima's most prized dish. Matt Goulding talked to contributor Von Diaz about his travels from tip to tail in Japan and why he thinks we need more books like this.
Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Vaughn.
So you've created a guidebook that's unlike anything I've ever seen, and it made me crave sushi for a week straight. What's the guiding
idea? Mission accomplished.
What's the guiding idea behind Rice Noodle Fish?
The basic principle here was that we don't want to be comprehensive. You know, that wasn't the goal here. It's not like a guidebook in that sense that no matter where you are in Japan, we're going to tell you what to eat in this particular moment. You know, I spent 3 months traveling around on the Shinkansen, the bullet train, eating at every region I could possibly get to. And at the end of all of that, I chose the 7 areas I think are the most sort of interesting culinary cultures to share with the Western reader. And so along the way, you know, there's different types of stories that we want to tell, you know, very specific ones about single shokunin dedicating their lives to this one task over and over, to much broader tales of a place like Hokkaido, which is the Japan beyond your imagination, where they're not making tofu and sake, they're making wine and cheese and charcuterie and beautiful artisanal breads.
It
feels like the Wild West up there. You know, the idea was to give you a tapestry, to give you as many different textures of this culinary culture as possible, so that you feel like when you've done reading this book, you have a really complete 360-degree view of what that culture is about.
This book is dedicated to the shokunin. Can you explain who they are?
Sure. The shokunin in Japan is a master artisan, a craftsperson who dedicates his or her time to the perfection of a single task. It could be making knives. It could be woodworking. It could be sushi or tempura. And this is the type of singular focus pervades the entire food culture of Japan.
And you spent a lot of time with the shokunin you profile. Did anyone stand out?
Man, I mean, everywhere you turn, you find these incredible stories of people who have given their entire lives to a micro-discipline that we in the Western world would find incredible. You know, to find a person who's been cooking nothing but tempura for 80 years of their life, it's a pretty remarkable thing. But, you know, a couple personal stories really, really reached out and touched me in a special way, in particular in Kyoto, in the heart of what's called kaiseki culture, which is kaiseki is sort of the elaborate multi-course feasts that are based in the traditions of the tea ceremony. You know, it's a very rigid, very codified way of eating. It's also a very beautiful way of eating. Mm. But I found a father and a son cooking in Arashiyama outside of Kyoto, Shunichi and Toshio Matsuno, who ran a place called Tempura Matsu. And despite the name, it's actually a full kaiseki restaurant right on the banks of a beautiful river. And what was so remarkable about this place was not just that they were experimenting and sort of breaking the rules of kaiseki in the Kyoto culture, where rules are not made to be broken, but also that the relationship they had in the kitchen was like none I've ever seen before in Japan. Normally, it's a master-apprentice relationship that informs all of Japanese cooking. You study underneath your master, which in many cases is your father, for as long as it takes for him to retire. And then you take the reins. Mm-hmm. That could be 40 or 50 years of watching your father really lead the kitchen. Now, in the case of the Matsuno family, there was a mutual respect there. The father sort of was rooted in the traditions of Kyoto cuisine, and the son had a much broader, more sort of experimental nature. And the two of them work in tandem, creating some of the most extraordinary meals that you're going to find in Japan. They became a major part of the book. They let me into their kitchen. They let me into their lives because they, you know, they operate the restaurant out of their home, which is very common in Japan. And they'd never done this before. And they made an exception for whatever reason. And I spent a few days with them doing everything that they did. And I found out not long afterwards that the father, who had been a little bit ill, actually had a stroke in the kitchen a few days later and has not returned to cook at Tempura Matsu since. So It's been a very emotional sort of relationship for both sides.
How do you hope people use this book?
Well, the idea is that you'll read the book, and whether or not you're planning on a trip to Japan immediately, you will close the book and immediately go on and book two tickets to Tokyo, hopefully building enough time for you to move about the country. And when you do that, then we also have a second part of this equation. We built out an online digital guide that has all of the real detailed information that you need to travel around Japan. So rather than putting it all into a book, which, you know, today with modern technology, just feels like carrying around the yellow pages in your backpack. Mm. It just doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. So we stripped out addresses, phone numbers, operating hours, maps, those types of pieces of information. We put them into a free online guide that's available in collaboration with Microsoft. You'll find a list of hundreds and hundreds of restaurants where I ate researching this book, where Tony Bourdain ate researching his shows over the years, and as well as a handful of our trusted advisors there on the ground, the smartest eaters in Japan, basically, giving us this information so that you'll have concrete guidance once you're there. And the truth is, in Japan, that's invaluable because oftentimes you're going to be standing in front of a restaurant, you're not going to be able to read what they're even serving. So to have that information, I think, is really vital for the Western traveler.
Matt, it's been great talking to you.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Matt Goulding is author of Rice Noodle Fish, Deep Travels Through Japan's Food Culture. Von Diaz is a writer and food editor of Feet in Two Worlds. Matt left us with his guide to the 8 wonders of the Japanese convenience store. Find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, eating to save our food diversity and spicing up your baking. I'm Melissa Clark, in for Lynn Rosetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its 4th season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food, while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This is A Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Melissa Clark, in for Lynn Rosetto Casper. Go to any supermarket and pick an aisle. Cereal, say, or yogurt. It seems as if we have an incredibly diverse selection of things to eat, but the fact is, we do not. While we have the capacity to grow thousands of edible plants, our industrial agriculture system has caused us to lose so much biodiversity that at this point, some three-quarters of our food comes from only 12 plants and 5 animal species. Simran Sethi is an environmentalist and journalist who documents this phenomenon in her new book, Bread, Wine, Chocolate: The Slow Loss of the Foods We Love. Our contributor, Washington Post food editor Joe Yonan, talked with Simran about her idea that true appreciation, learned through taste, might be the only way to keep our favorite foods from eventually disappearing.
Hi, Simran. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So you write that we're losing foods. What do you mean?
What I mean specifically is that we're losing biodiversity in foods. We're losing the diversity in every element that makes food and agriculture possible, from diversity in the soil to diversity and, you know, the actual existence of pollinators to the seeds that we sow, the fruits and vegetables that we grow, and even the animals that we raise for livestock.
So when I go into the supermarket, it sure doesn't seem like we don't have diversity. I look at the yogurt aisle alone, right?
Exactly. As a matter of fact, I decided to pay a visit to Walmart, which is the number one grocery chain in the United States, and I counted 153 flavors of ice cream, 8 different types of yogurt, and then I looked on to the sour cream and the butter and the cottage cheese, and, you know, it looks like we have a plethora of choice, but it's primarily in flavor and secondarily in brand. And I'm just using, you know, ice cream and dairy products as an example, but 90% of them came from one breed of cow, the Holstein Friesian.
Wow. So what difference does it ultimately make, Simran? Like, what are the stakes?
Well, the stakes are really quite high, Joe. And I'll tell you, it's not just relegated to ice cream and milk. You know, this is what we see echoing through the apples that we find in the grocery store. We have the capacity to grow over 7,500 apples all over the world, but less than 100 of them are grown commercially in the United States. And about 5 of them, including one that I have no idea why it's there, the Red Delicious, not at all delicious.
Only ends it's up on red, store but not
shelves.
Delicious. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Very red, not delicious. Exactly. And every historic fruit and vegetable variety that was once found in the U.S. has now disappeared. This matters because we need diversity for resilience. There's no investment advisor that would ever say, okay, Joe, take all of your savings and put them in one stock and cross your fingers and hope for the best. Yet globally, 95% of our calories now come from 30 species, and 3/4 of the food we eat comes from 12 plants and 5 animal species. And so we're creating this treacherous food system deliberately because it seems to make, of course, it seems to make more sense in terms of efficiency, in terms of scale, but it doesn't make sense for the actual product that is being created and one that we need in order to survive, and that's food.
And there have been some disastrous consequences of the loss of diversity through our history, right?
There indeed have. You know, the Irish potato famine was the result of a disease that wiped out most of the potatoes that were grown. One third of the population depended on potatoes for food, and one eighth of the population, about 1 million people, ended up dying. And it's not simply a consequence of the loss of biodiversity, but everything that's kind of around it. We see this happening right now with the loss of the Cavendish banana. It's a banana that replaced the banana that used to be in its place in the 1960s, known as the Gros Michel. And it's succumbing to a different strain of the exact same soil fungus that compromised the earlier banana. Now, if you think we can grow thousands of bananas, and we do globally, but now we've reduced this to just one banana that stands strong on store shelves and ships well, we realize that we're creating a really treacherous situation, and one that not only compromises the availability of the banana, but the availability of every single fruit and vegetable that we hold dear.
I was so fascinated by the story that you wrote about the pistachio, which, you know, it wasn't about industrialization really at all as much as politics, right?
Exactly. You know, the center of the world's pistachio industry used to be Iran. And back in 1929, a botanist traveled to Persia, which an area that's now Iran, to collect pistachios in hopes of finding a variety that would be suitable for growing in America. And out of 20 pounds of nuts that he gathered, there was only one variety that flourished. And that nut has become the foundation of the pistachio industry here in the United States. And the reason that American pistachios took over wasn't because of the loss of diversity in the Middle East, but it was because of a trade embargo that President Jimmy Carter imposed back in the 1980s as a result of the hostage crisis. So we see here that the ban that devastated the Iranian pistachio market ended up empowering the American one to build its capacity. So there are a host of reasons that we lose diversity in certain areas. Researchers recently learned, led by a gentleman named Colin Corey, that the whole world has moved toward what we call the global standard diet. We see pockets of biodiversity, but globally what we're seeing is a trend toward standardization, a trend toward wheat, rice, corn, soybeans, and palm oil. This is what the world is eating now. And this is a challenge because we see that in place of the crops that have been grown that were diverse are these standardized, high-yielding hybrids. And so if we lose the diversity, we lose the resilience that we have in order to reach back in and find solutions when a crop succumbs to disease or to pests or with climate change where we don't know exactly what will happen in the future. We need these backup systems. But conservationists haven't really considered us part of the equation, the eaters. We also have the power to transform this system. Anything outside of those five foods, the wheat, the rice, the corn, the soybeans, and the palm oil, becomes a revolutionary act. So this is really about pivoting in the grocery store toward the olive oil or turning toward the heirloom tomatoes or craft beer or the craft chocolate or the specialty coffee. All of these opportunities are in our hands, and they really are ones that will transform how food is grown and what is available.
Simran, thank you so much for sharing this with us. It's fascinating.
It's been my great pleasure. Thank you.
Simran Sethi is author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. Joe Yonan is the author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. In the spirit of conservation, be sure to check out our recipe for Little French Fudge Cakes. You'll find it at splendidtable.org. You know, when it comes to riffing on recipes, many of us are comfortable changing up the savory ones without much worry, but baking? Well, that's a whole other story. However, there is a relatively foolproof way to get creative with baked goods. Swap out or punch up the spices. In The New Sugar and Spice, A Recipe for Bolder Baking, author Samantha Senavaratna encourages that kind of play in the kitchen. Our contributor, Shauna Seaver, got the details.
Hi, Sam. It's great to talk with you.
Hey, Shauna.
So you and I are both avid bakers, and spices have long had a place in baking. It's actually hard to find a recipe without a splash of vanilla or a dash of cinnamon. But you take a really modern look at utilizing spices in baking. So tell us, what's really new about the new sugar and spice?
Well, I mean, I think the way that we used to talk about sugar and spice, the emphasis was on the sugar. And I think it's time that we start sort of looking at them in balance more and sort of making them work in tandem as opposed to one stronger than the other.
That's such an interesting idea. And everybody wants to talk about cutting back on sugar these days. And in your book, you talk about sugar as a spice in and of itself. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, as I was starting to do research into the spice trade and how it played out in history, I found out that sugar was once considered a spice. It was sort of as hard to come by as all the other spices. And so people sort of used it in their cooking that way, you know, sparingly and for special occasions. So I thought, you know, nowadays everyone's talking about how sugar is so bad for you. So instead of thinking about it as an evil ingredient, I sort of thought maybe we can just go back in history a little bit and think about a time when sugar was sort of one of the many spices that people used to flavor their foods and sort of reduce its importance a little bit and sort of help it play nice with everything else, you know, give spice a bigger part, basically, in all the recipes that I was creating.
Well, and you do. You have a go big or go home sort of thing with some of these recipes.
I use them very generously. It's true.
I love it. I've made your banana fritters, which are out of this world. And the amount of grated nutmeg you use is kind of startling at first. It's a couple tablespoons, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's
well,
a lot.
I want to emphasize, it's freshly grated nutmeg, which is much fluffier and sort of doesn't come across as dusty and strong as pre-ground nutmeg can be.
Definitely. That's such an interesting distinction, using the freshly grated versus what we're all used to getting from the supermarket. You know, who knows how long it's been sitting there, right?
It's true. You know, I have to say, there are some spices that I will condone pre-ground, but then there are some, like nutmeg, where it really, really makes a huge difference if you grind it yourself or grate it yourself.
You were talking a little bit before about the history of spices, and one of the things I find so charming about your book is the way that you really talk about your personal history and your personal connection to spices. And your family, your parents are from Sri Lanka, your extended family as well, and you spent a lot of summers growing up in Sri Lanka, which some of the best spices in the world come from that area. I can only imagine that really influenced your baking and the topic of this book.
It's true. I mean, it's so... I feel very lucky. I had a really magical childhood. I was born in Connecticut and grew up there. And then when I spent my summers back in Sri Lanka with my grandmother and my cousins and my aunts and uncles, I sort of saw a totally different way of cooking and saw things growing, you know, right in our backyard that I had never seen. Avocados grew like crazy, pumpkins, spices. You know, everything. My dad always says you just have to basically drop something in the ground and it just grows. You don't have to do anything. The land is so beautiful and so fertile.
It sounds like paradise. My gosh. And some of that influenced the recipes in the book. I absolutely love the flavors in your grandmother's True Love cake. It sounds so exotic. Tell us a little bit about that recipe.
Love cake is a super classic Sri Lankan dessert. Everybody knows it. Everybody makes it. Everybody eats it. It's everywhere. This version that I made in my book still has quite a bit of sugar. It's a sweet, sweet cake. But my version has a little bit less, and I've certainly upped the spices. Cardamom is by far my favorite spice, so I put a lot of cardamom in there. You know, it's very fragrant. It's got rose water and honey and almonds, and it just has more flavor than you would ever imagine in such a small bite of cake, but it's magical.
It does sound magical.
You don't
magical.
Need to eat very much.
No, you don't.
It packs a big punch.
And that's a really good point. So many of your desserts are really about the smaller portion and the huge flavor, which I love. And you've used spices to create not only more exotic, internationally influenced treats, but pumped up versions of more traditional American treats. I've been craving those salt and pepper caramel brownies and that gingered strawberry rhubarb pie. It just sounds incredible. And it really got me thinking about some of the easiest ways for home bakers to start playing with spices in unfamiliar ways. So what would be maybe a good sort of gateway spice for trying more interesting flavors in baked goods?
Well, like I said, cardamom. I mean, I think cardamom's huge in Europe and Scandinavia and Middle East and South Asia and all over. But for some reason, in the United States, cardamom doesn't really win people over as easily. So I'd say if you have, you know, a favorite cookie that just includes cinnamon, maybe try swapping it out for cardamom. That seems like a nice, easy foray into getting more exotic with your spices.
Ooh, that sounds great. Well, thank you so much, Samantha. It's been great chatting with you.
You too, Shauna. Thank you for having me.
Samantha Senavaratna's book is Sugar and Spice. Shauna Seaver is the author of Real Sweet. Head to our website to find Sam's recipe for salt and pepper caramel brownies and banana fritters. That's splendidtable.org. Vinegar is one of the most powerful tools in a cook's arsenal. Longtime listeners to Lynn here on The Splendid Table know how crazily devoted she is to vinegar. Some say she was one of the first to put balsamic on the American culinary map. Well, a couple of weeks ago, she dug into another one of her loves, apple cider vinegar.
One of the most underrated vinegars in this country is apple cider vinegar. Granted, it's kind of on trend now, but it's interesting to me with all the fuss over vinegars, you know, chocolate, balsamic, anybody. We ignore this thing that's been around forever. It's not only good in dressings, but it's great in cooking, and not just marinades, by the way. You boil it down, maybe with a little bit of actual apple juice. It's the most delicious glaze. But I have here 6 different vinegars. I don't know what they are. The glasses are just numbered. And everything here goes from an apricot color to almost a pinkish color to a real gold. So what should an apple cider vinegar taste like? Apples. Now, I know normally you would not drink a vinegar straight, but this is the only way to know what the quality is. Okay, how do you taste vinegar? Well, you taste vinegar by taking some in your mouth and sucking a little air over it, just the way you would taste olive oil. Okay? But the thing is, you have to rinse your mouth and spit, because otherwise you're going to be pickled. Okay, we're going to start number one. Tart, has some suggestion of apples. It's rather pleasant, leaves a very dry, almost woody flavor. And some vinegars are actually processed through wood chips. So this may be the reason why. Number two, this is a little on the cloudy side, leaning toward an apricot color. That has a soft, appley quality that's quite appealing. It's rather delicate and not as acidic as number one was. All right, moving on to number three. Not a distinctive nose on any of these yet. Number three is a yellowish color with a touch of orange, and it's cloudy too. Okay, let's see. For me, number three doesn't have an apple in it. Or I don't taste an apple. So it's there probably, but it's a nice vinegar. But there's nothing distinctive about it for me. Then we go on to number four. Now, this is one of the clear ones. And it almost reminds me of the color of a rosé, except it looks like a sunset. Okay. Very soft. Not hit you over the head acidic. A nice apple quality. This would be a lovely thing to dress delicate flavored greens. I would sprinkle this over something like green beans that you've steamed, tomatoes. They're really a nice vinegar. So we're going to give number four kind of a gold star. Okay, number five. Now, this is almost clear, very, very pale. Very pale, yellow. This is interesting because there's sweetness to it. And it's quite appley. And it's also the most spoonable of all of them that I've tasted. This would be great. I wonder what would happen if you boiled this down and then you just drizzled a little bit over a really creamy dessert or in an apple pie. This is a really nice vinegar, but it does have sweetness. And if you want tart vinegar, this wouldn't be your baby. But I think it's a really nice one. Now to number six. Number six is the most clear, crystal clear, amber colored. Okay. I would say, okay, not a lot of flavor, but a lot of acid. Nice body, but not a favorite. So, I think I have to give it to number four. So, can I now find out what I've been drinking? Our producer, Jen Russell, is coming in. Ta-da!
Drum roll.
Drum roll.
Four is the winner.
Ah-ha-ha! Oh, this is interesting. Okay, let me tell you what we tasted. We tasted Williams-Sonoma, Eden, which you find in co-ops, health food stores, etc. Bragg, a standby for so many people. That was number three. Aspall, which is a British cider vinegar. Very interesting. Okay, the next one is Katz. That's number five. That's the one that was slightly sweet. Now, I do know Katz. They produce in California. And then the last one was Heinz. Okay. So from, you know, what we find on the shelf all the time to some kind of special ones. So if my number four won, it's the Aspall. I love the fact it's organic. So, Jen, where did you get this one?
You know, I picked that up at Whole Foods.
Really? How much was it?
Well, let me check. I have my receipts.
Okay.
$3.39 at Whole Foods.
For 11 ounces organic cider vinegar Aspall. That's really reasonable. This is an English import, by the way. And they've been making cider vinegar since 1728 in Suffolk, England. You know, that's really...
I know. What a deal.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, if you can't find the Aspall, I would say my number two, my runner-up, would be the Eden Organic. Okay? So that's our apple cider vinegar tasting. Go forth, make salad, baste pork, and be happy.
You can find the results of that vinegar tasting at splendidtable.org. Lynn is out of the office, and I'm sitting in her chair. Coming up, I get to talk to you. I'm Melissa Clark, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Melissa Clark from The New York Times, in this week for Lynn. We've gotten some questions on social media about how to make tortillas at home. So we called in master tortilla maker Alex Stupak for some advice. Alex is a chef of New York City's revered Mexican restaurants, Empeón Cocina, Empeón Taqueria, and Empeón Al Pastor. Welcome, Alex. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, just break it down for us and tell us that making tortillas at home isn't scary.
It's not scary at all. It's not even a recipe. It's a technique. And if you enjoy playing with Play-Doh when you were a kid, you're going to enjoy doing this.
Really? What's the connection between Play-Doh and tortillas?
Well, you have masa. Masa is a dough made from corn, mm-hmm. and it's soft and malleable, and it just feels great to hold.
And okay, so what is the difference between masa dough and just a regular cornmeal dough?
Okay, so masa is a dough made from corn, but the corn has been nixtamalized first. So most of the corn that covers the earth is a grain. It's starchy, it's dense, and it's difficult to digest. You wouldn't want to eat it in its raw state.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to go through a process to make it, one, delicious, but also nourishing. So you boil this field corn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hominy, dent corn. There's all different varieties, but they're all devoid of sugar, very starchy.
Right.
And you boil this corn with limestone, and it softens it, and it makes it smell better and taste better. And then if you grind it, it makes this dough.
But you don't have to do that because when you buy Mesa Harina, it's done for you?
Yes. Yeah. This is not a process that anyone could do in their home anyways.
Okay.
The nixtamalization process is very easy, but to actually grind that, you need very special types of volcanic stone. So thank God there is Mesa Harina, which is what we should get people excited about going out to buy to make tortillas.
And where can you find Mesa Harina?
I've never not seen it in a grocery store.
Wow.
There's different
okay.
brands. And again, it's shelf stable. So to buy 5 pounds of it and have it in your pantry indefinitely is not a bad thing.
So once you have the right kind of cornmeal, so you have this Mesa Harina,
mm-hmm.
and then what's the next step?
You add water.
Okay.
And then you have masa.
And then you make Play-Doh. That's it?
Yep, that's it.
Wow.
Okay. And how much water? I mean, are you looking for something that is as thick as Play-Doh, a little thinner?
You're looking for something as soft as possible without it actually sticking to your hand.
Okay. And then once you have it, do you let it sit? Do you form it? What happens next?
You don't need to let it sit. It's ready to go. When you're working with it, you just want to keep it covered with a moist towel because it dries out rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Then you need two other pieces of gear. You need a tortilla press. And you need a sturdy piece of plastic, either a plastic sandwich bag or you can cut up a trash bag because you need to put two pieces of plastic on both sides of the tortilla press. Then you're basically rolling a golf ball-sized ball and
right.
you're pressing it out and you're going to have a raw tortilla in your hand.
And then you just fry it?
Put it in a hot skillet.
Wow. What if you don't have a tortilla press? Is there any workaround for people who maybe want to try making tortillas at home before they commit to buying a tortilla press? Can you roll it out with a rolling pin?
You can try in between two sheets of plastic. You can also try patting it out with your hand.
Isn't that what I've seen them do that
right.
on TV?
Yeah, so hand-padded tortillas, that's actually the apex of tortilla forming skill.
Uh-huh.
So again, I really recommend like buying a tortilla press. You can buy one on Amazon or something. They're not expensive. They're like $15.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So low investment to try it out.
Yeah, I think they're worth having around.
Now, are there different styles of tortillas in the different parts of Mexico? Or would this basic masa tortilla be something that you'd find all over the country?
So a tortilla is going to be made out of masa. Corn is king there.
Mm-hmm.
If you start getting into the northern parts, flour tortillas do start to pop up, but it's much, much less common. Now, tortillas, how they're shaped or the size of them, that varies from region to region.
I see.
I don't think anyone needs to worry about that, though. I think people just need to try this once and not obsess over the shape. If yours looks a little amoebic and not round, it's still okay. It's still going to be better than buying something that's days old and then reheated.
Right. And how long will it keep, though? Will it? I mean, because I know when I buy a package of tortillas in the supermarket, it will last for days. Do the fresh ones last, or do you need to use them immediately?
See, now you need to use them right away.
Okay.
And that's the real point of all this is that usually the ingredient missing from good Mexican food is freshness. So we wouldn't dare to reheat pasta, or we wouldn't dare to make risotto days in advance and reheat it. But for some reason with tortillas, we're all afraid of them. But it's actually easier to make a tortilla when you think about it than it is to make risotto.
Wow. That is such a good point. I would never have thought about it. Okay. You have inspired me. I'm going to try it. Thank you so much for coming and talking to us today.
Thank you.
Alex Stupak's new book is appropriately titled Tacos, Recipes, and Provocations. He left us with a recipe for corn tortillas. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org.
The number you have reached has been disconnected.
Now it's your turn to call me, and I will answer any of your questions about food or eating. You can find us at Facebook, Twitter, or pick up the phone and give us a call. We're at 800-537-5252. We have Oscar on the line. Oscar, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Kingston, Ontario in Canada.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
Yeah.
How can I help you?
Okay, so in December, we had a housemate move out, and he left behind a bunch of really interesting pantry items. Among them is like this peanut butter jar full of tiny dried shrimp.
Ooh. Dried shrimp are used a lot in all parts of Asia. And so what are you planning to do with them?
Well, I did a little bit of research because I'm not familiar with it, and a lot of the websites that I went to said that it pretty much goes in a soup where you might be using bacon as a starter for salt or something like meaty.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure that they weren't bad. They weren't like breaking or brittle. They're still fairly like chewy.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I'm really quite at a loss.
Well, okay, so you've checked, you know that they're good. There are two ways you can use them. You can grind them into a powder, and you can use them as shrimp powder, and that you can add basically anywhere you want a little bit of salt, a little bit of like an umami kind of punch. You can add this dried shrimp powder. And if you grind it into a powder, you should use it right after you grind it, because once you grind it, it's going to start to release all of its good flavors. So, you know, pound it up.
So like coffee.
Exactly. You know, pound it up and then throw it into your dish. Soups would be great. Stir fries with noodles. But if you also wanted to use them whole. Now, how dried are they? They're still chewy, you said.
They're still chewy, and they're shelf stable.
Okay, so what you want to do is you want to rehydrate them a little bit. So you just soak them in water. You can use warm water, and they'll start to tenderize just a little. And maybe soak them for an hour, then drain them, and then you can add them to vegetable stir fries. You can add them to you know how they're really great is if you use them in a sauce. So with other fresh seafood, or use them in a soup. So say that you're making a big seafood. Do you ever make a big like seafood stew or soup? Is that something that you would do?
Yeah, I basically cook for the week and then just eat what I made one day for seven.
Oh yeah, perfect. And so just add them whenever you're cooking fish. I don't know if you ever do tofu stews, but they're also great with tofu. There's something about the combination of the soft bean curd and then the little chewy bits of shrimp, which is really nice with lots of vegetables. You can do it in a soy-based broth. You can do it with miso. Another way, if you wanted to do something a little less expected, add them wherever you would normally add anchovies. So do you ever, you know, if you ever think of using anchovies with meat? You know, to add that, again, that umami flavor, you can use the dried shrimp instead.
Very cool.
Oh, I'm excited to hear what you're going to, so what do you think? What's your first idea here?
Probably I'm going to try a stew or, try that with tofu. I eat a lot of tofu and I've been looking for ways to mix that up.
Oh, great.
So, yeah.
Perfect. And so maybe some vegetables, bok choy would be good in that or, or kimchi. Oh, my gosh. You could add some kimchi. Oh, you know what else you can do? You could actually make your own kimchi. Have you ever made kimchi?
I've made vegetarian kimchi, so no fish in it whatsoever. But I know that dried shrimp, is a pretty key ingredient to traditional kimchi. So
yeah, exactly. So it's very traditional. You'd add the dried shrimp, you know, right at the beginning, and then it's just going to add this funky whole other layer of flavor. And then when you add the kimchi to, have you ever made a Korean kimchi soup? It's with the tofu. Oh my gosh! If you use the kimchi that has the dried shrimp kind of infused in it, it's fantastic.
Yeah. That sounds great. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're so welcome. You are making me hungry. Thank you so much for calling.
Oh, thank you, Melissa. Have a good day.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
You know, even though that the shrimp is shelf stable, it'll actually keep better if you keep it either in the fridge or even in the freezer. If you want to get in touch, you can get to us through Facebook or Twitter or pick up the phone and give us a call at 800-537-5252. And now we have Tom on the line. Tom, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Los Angeles, California.
Oh, wonderful. And how can I help you?
Well, I actually am a partner in three restaurants called Hugo's Restaurants in Los Angeles. And we've been doing a lot with sorghum.
Okay.
It's a grain that I know not many people are familiar with, but it's actually the fifth most used grain in the world. And it's very drought tolerant and takes very little water to grow. So we have been playing around with it for the last 6 or 8 months on our menu.
Oh, fantastic.
And coming up with lots of recipes and just was kind of wondering if you had, in your expertise, any useful hints about sorghum.
Oh, that's so interesting. So, you know, when I think of sorghum, I usually think of sorghum syrup. I don't usually think of the grain itself. Do you ever use the syrup?
Right. We're using the syrup and, you know, for baking and for pancakes and things like that in the Southern tradition. But using the grain like rice, like popcorn, like flakes that we make cereals and
I think you know more about it than I do. That's fantastic, you know. Does the grain, is it like a wheat berry?
Well, it kind of looks like a large couscous.
Uh-huh.
So bigger than quinoa, a little bigger than couscous. And it has a flavor I like in somewhere in between wheat and rice. So it's kind of a very mild flavor.
Uh-huh.
So it takes well to whatever you're cooking it with. And it's very manipulative. So you can cook it and grind it. You can and make it like we make it into patties, or you can grind it whole grain and use it easily as a flour that way.
Oh, fantastic.
You can pop it like popcorn.
I have done that. That's right.
Yeah, we roast it and make horchata out of it.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Okay, well, it seems like you're going to give me the ideas on how to use sorghum. I have popped sorghum. I have made it. They're teeny weeny little grains, and they just pop. You add them to a pot of oil, and they pop up, and they're delicious. What do you do with that? Do you just serve it, or do you put it on something?
Yeah, we've used it as a topping for dishes. You know, more of a
fun garnish.
A topping. Yeah, a garnish.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess the question is, what would I do with it? Because I haven't had a lot of experience with it. The first thing that comes to mind is pilaf. I'm sure you guys have already thought of that, right? To use it as pilaf. Or what about using it as a coating for protein? You know, if you could, I'm thinking of the popped little sorghum, crushing it, and then using that to coat fish before you saute it, or chicken before you saute it. What do you think of that?
I hadn't thought of it. We played around with using it just, you know, as a flour like you would a normal breading, but not topped. I like that idea.
Oh, good. I'm glad I had something for you.
Don't give it a little extra crunch to it.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it sounds like you guys are really on the sort of cutting edge of sorghum use. And I know that you can buy sorghum. I think even Bob's Red Mill sells it. I think you can get it pretty much nationwide. It's good to know that it doesn't use a lot of water, which is good for all of us, whether we're in drought conditions or not. So we should probably be eating more sorghum, right? And you say the flavor is very mild and delicious.
And it has more antioxidants than pomegranates or blueberries. It's anti-inflammatory. It has a low glycemic index. And it's just as nutritious as quinoa.
Wow.
So I'm not really sure why everybody isn't using sorghum, honestly.
Well,
it's so easy to use.
Thank you for calling and helping spread the word. And I'm glad I was able to give... You've given me about 10 ideas. I'm glad I was able to give you one.
I hope we can find it on your website soon.
I hope so, too. Well, thank you so much for calling.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Take care now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Wait, my time is up. I have to stop. Well, I had a great time today. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, or pick up the phone and give us a call at 800-537-5252. Lynn will be back next week. And in the meantime, I want to leave you with one thought from Tallulah Bankhead. She said, "If I had to live my life over again, I'd make the same mistakes, only sooner." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. You can find the recipes you heard about and information on our guests and their books and work at splendidtable.org. Register for the newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, subscribe to the weekly Splendid Table podcast, and register for our occasional giveaways. That's splendidtable.org. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Clark, and this is APM.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.